This is the annual technical session, and it is going to be chaired by the chairman of the committee, the technical committee, Tom Owen. I want to mention that I think that we were hearing both sides of stories. Yesterday we heard some vehement anti-digital sentiments. Today we're obviously going to hear some pro-digital sentiments. But I think also the one thing that the people yesterday did not realize that there are other reasons, other purposes for using digital other than just for storage of sound. And that some of these things, some of these purposes are some of the cataloging, etc., as well as picture is a important aspect of it also. So I will turn it over to Tom right now.
Testing 1, 2. After yesterday's presentation by Clark, we made it mandatory for the entire technical committee this morning to have natural wheat germ for breakfast, which we did. At any rate, we're going to talk about high-density storage more so than digital recording versus analog recording. At least I am, and I think Fred is, and some others. Let me introduce the panel. This is Jerry Gibson from the Library of Congress on the left, Lloyd Stickles from the British Library, and Fred Granger from the Museum of Man, right? The National Technical Director. As we know it, in optical disk storage or recording, there are several different methods that are being employed these days. Most of you are familiar with laser discs. There are two types of laser discs primarily. There's CLV, constant linear velocity type disc, which are mostly movies, and constant angular velocity laser disc, which I'm going to be primarily talking about. This is the type of disc where you can store the 54,000 frames and have access to each individual frame if you want. Another type of direct laser disc writing is called a draw system, which stands for direct read after write. This is a system that's been around for about 2 or 3 years. We've done extensive testing with the draw system at Rodgers and Hammerstein at the New York Public Library, as I believe the Library of Congress also has, and Fred has also. Something about what we call a CAV disc, are the kind of the disc I just described where you can get 54,000 frames, individual frames on. There's approximately 140 billion pits per side, if you've seen the pictures of how the pits are drawn in these discs. And each one of those pictures has two fields connected to it in terms of video. So you can use what is known as SMPTE time code or a frame number to get at that particular frame. That's why you see a training disc and that sort of thing. You can get to an exact frame number anywhere on that disc within something like a second or a half a second in some systems. That's very important. In our particular archive, we have lots of manufacturers' catalogs. We have things that we would like to reduce the storage requirements on, like magazines and other type of print materials. This is an ideal way to do this, as well as digitizing to laser disc, which is something I'm going to get to in a second. Now, I had a whole thing to do, but I'm going to have to cut mine part short because these other folks have been so nice to bring things from England and elsewhere. And they all have slides and things to show. So I'm just going to mention these systems, and then Fred and Jerry and Lloyd are going to go into detail about what we're calling high-density storage, what I'm calling high-density storage. So we talked about two laser systems, CAV and CLV. There's the compact disc, which at the present time, in the audio sense, will hold approximately 60 minutes of audio time. 60 minutes if you want to have any real error correction capabilities and utilize some indexing, okay? In a compact disc, there are 8 subcode fields. And you can, right now, they're only using 2 of them, so who knows what they're going to use those other 6 for. But that's a little too technical to get into right here. You have the draw system, the direct read after write, which is a machine available from several people. Thompson from France, Panasonic has it. The one that we tested at R&H is the Panasonic OMDR machine, and several others that Fred will be speaking about. So these systems, and also the CD-ROM, which I'm doing some investigating on right now, these particular digital systems of storage in our world, meaning the archive world, both sound, print, and non-print material, are extremely important because we can put, even out of the audio world, the picture collection at the New York Public Library, you could put on two discs the entire black and white picture collection of the New York Public Library. Much of it's already cataloged, and therefore you could take the information from the database, the Arlen database, and access this information. Therefore, nobody would be touching those particular photographs. You could replicate those discs and offer them to other libraries at minimal cost. We're looking at that. We're looking at doing the same thing with sound, restoration of sound, using these discs to pass around, restoration of cataloging in the sense where you can create a CD-ROM disc and pack approximately 500.5 megabytes of information on a CD-ROM. That's a lot of cataloging. And that can be loaded into a machine that's not much bigger than this little system that you see right here and accessed rather quickly. So these are the systems that we're going to be talking about, and I'm going to let Fred come up and expound on this. So we'd like to bring up Fred Granger. You want to do it over there?
Again this year, I'm very pleased to be back in our family, which consists of such a wide variety of people of different backgrounds that it takes us a long time to find out what kind of thread that binds us all together. The element that I seem to find around here all the time is the sincere love of very old music and the necessity to catalog this material now before an awful lot of this is not going to be available in the future. The point that I refer to is the AAA project, which is going to be a milestone to an awful lot of smaller facilities and their ability to be able to get access to documentation on systems. It is in these references that up in Ottawa we are looking for methods of storing material, not in the acoustical form, mostly visual things such as photographs, videotapes, films, things of that type. We're transferring over to optical disc. I was making a couple of references earlier as regard to some of the people and their passion that goes on within their own expertise, and I gave reference to the fact that were I to walk down one of these little lanes here and hum a tune that I was making up in my head at the time, I'm sure that one of the members in the association would pop up out of nowhere and run over and name the tune that I'm making up and give it a stamper number and tell me when the potential new reissue is going to take place. But now we can. Yes, the point of but the intensity that we get into these different things is remarkable, that we can all actually sit around and not be bombing each other. I attend other associations where they take things very, very seriously, but I always associate the ARSC group with that of a family of different forms of brothers and sisters. But it's my pleasure again to be here this year and to meet all of our people. Each year we have such a good time. I'm going to bring up the same points that I have in a couple of years past, and it's for that reason that we have over the last years been subject to a myriad of slides and such the like. And for those of you that have basically had enough, I say that today I have brought no slides. What we're going to be doing is just basically talking about what the National Museums Corporation Canada, which consists of 167 museums controlled by basically a small bureaucracy, which is the National Museums Corporation. We subsidize a large portion of the national of the museums in the provinces and the municipalities, and when they require to get into different kinds of optical programs, such as they want something to be used in an exhibit other than film or videotape, because the two mediums themselves require mechanical maintenance and have to be replacing the medium itself, the problems that people have in smaller facilities is that they don't have the technical staff to continue to go out and repair these things. And we have found in a lot of cases, even in our larger museums, that the exhibits will have broken down and not being repaired for quite some time because people, they're small, there's only, for an example, a large museum, we may have two or three audiovisual technicians going around doing the servicing. So we're looking for some alternate form of medium to get the material out there that will stay in reasonable shape without the requirements of continual maintenance. If you put, for an example, a videotape that plays 8 hours a day or more, just continues to recycle and play as a part of an exhibit, you have to start replacing these things in a couple of weeks because the dropouts become very obtrusive and people will let you know about it very quickly. We have felt that for the new museum, which we're presently building, approximately 5 years ago, we started planning and constructing the building. And at this point in time, I don't know which came first, the construction or the design, because we're constantly changing a number of different things. We've been assigned $90 million for the building, and I feel that we're going to be 1 year late with probably a $30 million overrun. This is a lot to do with putting better quality exhibits inside the museum than what we've had in the other museums. My work with the National Museums Corporation is a function of being basically absconded by the corporation to get me to do work that they are not, they're a fairly small number. There's about 150 people in the group, and they just don't have enough time with all the construction that have been going on. We also have a National Gallery, which is being rebuilt, and we're on the same time frame, and we fight for the same additional funds from our government. They also are a little bit over on their expected finishing costs, but both of our problems remain the same. We're, as we look into an awful lot of the projections that were made 5 years ago, they were made on the basis of existing mediums like audiovisual equipment, and we're trying to get things converted over onto something that we have tried already. We have run an awful lot of tests on these, and we find that the mechanical maintenance is considerably less on using an optical disc machine. If you look at something in the form of Epcot, which use an awful lot of exhibits, so the chief engineer of the facility has, we have worked with the people down there quite a bit, and once they got a couple of the bugs out, their exhibits are running very well, the interactive facilities. And one of those silliest bugs was that they mounted the video disc playback units in a rack, and some fellow was afraid that as he pulled the drawer out that maybe the video disc player would fall off the table. So he cut four holes in the bottom of the table and let the legs fall down, and it made it very secure, but it cut the fan circulation to practically zero, and motors started popping on the things, and they were screaming to the manufacturers, and the fellows came out and said, no air, you know, no air. So they redesigned that slightly, and in fact, what they're saying is that in all the time they've been running since, they have not had to have any maintenance on the equipment. They have done it, gone through and checked and checked. So that's the kind of look that we have towards digital equipment, in the sense that optical disc equipment, for the reliability of operating maintenance, we can cut down considerable costs in the future on the new museum if we try to employ equipment that we don't have to spend a great deal time and in terms of manpower on maintaining. If, for example, you take a look at a 16 mil loop projector, some of the old Philips models, which we have in our existing museum, eat film. They love it. They just, you feed the film to it, and you walk away, and it comes back and practically burps when you're walking out of the room, and you look at it again, and it starts grinding and working again. We have to find these kinds of machinery that can help us to to get the exhibits running. I think Epcot has spent an awful lot of money, and I love it when somebody else spends money, like Jerry here. They spend an awful lot of money doing tests on different things, and we reap the benefits because we just watch the errors and try to stay away from those pitfalls. One of the things that we are doing in the form of testing, and starting in September, we have been able to get a number of companies into what Tom was referring to earlier, draw equipment. That's direct read after write. That's where you can record the discs in your house and play them back immediately and couple them to a microcomputer. Basically, we're using the XT, IBM XT types, because a lot of the programs and interfacing cards, control cards, and what I call visual massage material, like Corvus, Videtics, those kind of boards that you can zoom in on on an image. You can have a still picture of, say, a vase, and you want to see a little portion of it, so you push a zoom effect, and it'll go right into that portion. Now, this is a still photograph that you just at one time recorded on the disc, but now you can do things with it, like you want an overlay, you want some on the bottom of it to describe what it is and give you some information. The overlays are, if you don't want to see these things, you just don't push the button as you're looking at the material playing. We have a large number of artifacts in the National Museums Corporation, considering the number of museums that we have. In our own Museum of Man, we have 5.5 million artifacts that are all documented, not all photographed. About half of them are photographed. Normally what we do is that as an artifact comes in the door, we photograph it, fumigate it, and then pass it on to somebody to take a look at for the repair of it, or what we can do with it, what kind of collection it goes into, catalog all the information on it. We found that because we started getting a backlog in photography, that right now if we were to try to get color photography of all the artifacts instead of an awful lot of black and white that was done in years past, it would cost us well over $3.5 million just to do the photography of the material. If we photograph and provide slides, we have to provide humidity and temperature control facilities, as we do now for original acoustical and photographic and videotape mediums. And we find that the cost isn't very good to us at this time. So what we have found out is that we will take the a draw disc system, which has a relatively good resolution. In terms of not, I'm trying to stay away from terms like pixels and how many pixels per line horizontally, vertically, and how much database space are you storing per image and things of that type. I think, and all of our people think basically that an optical disc unit is nothing more or less than a peripheral device to a microcomputer. It is in the form of a floppy disk, a hard disk drive, and going onwards to what I can perceive the optical disc to be is as a massive bucket. So this bucket is simply a tool that you can use with your computer to store whatever kind of thing you want with that digital information. You can store data text in the sense of our computer information that relates to all our artifacts. We can store the visual material, which is the transfer of an analog to a digital signal from a video camera. And we can store the, in terms of analog as well, some form of audio, either that be music or speech. The problem with that, as has been indicated by a number of people already, is that perhaps the specifications that have been fought out amongst the originators of the CD have not been of good or a wise choice. Because they do affect certain frequencies that may affect some people's health. I don't believe that the Surgeon General will ever come out with a proclamation that listening to to compact discs will cause medical disorders. I don't go to that extreme. But I do say that if it causes someone a lot of problem, it might be associated with a Brüel-Kerr study that was done in Europe. That they do some low-frequency testing on unsuspecting people in their own plant. They physically agitated a building by putting some very massive exciters that they use in their testing in the basement, and they shook the building at, I think it was 7 cycles. It can't be heard. Very few things around are going to measure it. But after a short period of time, in terms of 2 weeks, people who at that plant are very, very friendly. I've been to the plant in Copenhagen, and the people are, they work in teams, and they work very, very well. After a couple of weeks, these people were becoming more and more agitated, and they were dropping out and coming up and saying, I can't come, I can't stay here this afternoon. I'm going home. I don't feel well. That was all across the area where they had these low-frequency exciting going on. It was a test that they wanted to perform in order to do some psychoacoustics. Now, maybe that has some form of result with some frequency effect in the CD. If that's the case, then people who are extremely sensitive to those frequencies may be able to sense when a next earthquake is going to come, because animals who are running around in the field can feel this thing long, long in advance. So I don't know. It just see people who are super sensitive, and it must be a rare people if that happens. But I think there's going to be a lot of changes take place in the very near future on CDs in reference to how people store material. We have an option of storing analog to digital material in whatever format you want, because that real estate that you have in terms of pits on the disc can be used the way, in whatever format you prefer. We have Communications Research Council in Canada, Bell Northern Research, and a physics facility within the University of Montreal are looking into, they have already quite a large number of different kind of analog to digital converters that they use in the telephone system, and in CRC they use it for telecommunication systems. They've already come up with a lot of boxes and such that are very effective in transferring the thing, transferring the material over, and they don't use the same coding techniques or whatever. I like the sound and of what I've heard so far from some of these things, and we want to throw them into that test that we're running, which is a test between a variety of different pieces of equipment. Starting in September to December, we're using control data, their OSI 1200 model of draw. We're using Thomson CSF, which is their model 1001. We're using Panasonic, their analog draw disc. And we were fortunate enough to get recently an agreement through Sony Corporation that they have shipped out of their labs in Tokyo a unit for UL inspection and approval in the United States. And as soon as that's passed the approval state, we'll start using that in our test. Now, the purpose of this test in terms of running film onto disc and running still frames or sound or visuals and trying all these different devices is to find out how easy that we in the museum, the humans, relate to incorporating these things into their office. I don't know how many people have had the experience of working in an office and somebody shoving a microcomputer on their desk and saying, from now on, we're modern. You don't know what you're going to do with it and how does it apply to different things. Well, we have that in museums as well, and people who have worked very, very well in, for a long period of time on their existing systems are not going to be literally tied and beaten and dragged into other rooms with new equipment. We want them to work with it and tell us what they don't like about it, what they like about it. And from that point, as the results of the test finished in January, we'll be doing some summing and recommendation to the National Museum Corporation for implementation in all of the different museums, this kind of equipment for the kind of about 20 applications that we're looking at. So that's all that that we're doing. It's not a lot. We could do more. There's a couple more hours that we sleep every day. I'd like to turn it back over to Tom, because I'd like to try to keep the things short so that we can have a lot of fun talking back and forth.
This is on, yeah. Next, Jerry Gibson's going to entertain us and enlighten us.
I don't know about enlighten. Pardon? In flame? I'm going to try to go up in flame for you, too. Tom has agreed that I could, in addition to the optical disc, the Library of Congress this past year has had a couple of, one a piece of information and the second a development of a new container, an archival container, which I would like to share with both of you. Put that in later. Can we get the lights?
This is a slide projection. You want that bike?
Approximately 4 months ago now, the end of February, George Kipper, a man who some of you know, and if you don't know him, you will know him shortly, because he's as knowledgeable and enthusiastic about sound recordings as many of us here are, and in fact, more so in many areas than many of us are. George came to me and said, by the way, are you aware that celluloid-type cylinders are made out of the same stuff that nitrate cellulose film are made of? If you're not aware of it and are aware of the problems that it presents, if you have nitrate film, it raises real potential problem, at least. I'll play this videotape, which I'll play at the same time I'm talking, and I'm hoping it's cued to the right place, is of a test fire burning in 1948. The National Archives took approximately 5,000 pounds of nitrate film, controlled burning of it, and if my memory serves me correct, this is actual time on the burning. 5,000 pounds of film would be slightly under 800 reels, pardon me, slightly over 800 reels, so it's not a hell of a lot of film. It totally consumes itself in something like 4 minutes. It burns at 20 to 30 times the speed of wood, at 20 to 30 times the heat of wood. It gives off such charming things as cyanide and nitric oxides, which when mixed with moisture and air and other chemicals it gives off, produces nitric acid. It is very deadly. It has a flash point when new of something like 230 degrees Fahrenheit. It hasn't been consciously or intentionally manufactured since the early 50s, at least not in North America. At a deteriorated point of condition, it has a flash point, ignition point of something between 90 and 100 degrees Fahrenheit. There's not too many areas in North America that at one point or another during each annual cycle that the temperature is not well above that. So if you have any, please be aware of it. So that's part of the reason why this film is, when it's over, by the way, when it's burned out, let me know, and I'll turn it off. It's simply to give you a graphic picture of it. I apologize for the quality of it. I challenged George. Pardon me?
That was on nitrate
side. No, that was the 16 millimeter. They were not using nitrate for the test. It's also about 12 generations removed and was just this past week transferred to videotape. I questioned George. Quite honestly, I didn't think he knew what he was talking about. I hoped he didn't know what he was talking about. And challenged him to bring me the documentation for his information. 2 days later, he came back in with a copy of an article from the Antique Phonograph Monthly, written by an ARSC member, I believe, Mark Kaplan, who's also a chemist at Kodak, entitled Breaking the Mold, A Chemist Looks at Wax's Enemy. Is that all of it, I think? Pardon? No, it's different tests. I called Dr. Kaplan, and by the way, he included two sentences in his article in the Antique Phonograph Monthly about nitrate cellulose film, or nitrate cellulose cylinders, assuming that everybody knew that they were celluloid, was nitrate cellulose. I called him, and I also called Leah Barrett at the Edison Historical Site. Dr. Kaplan got back in touch with me, furnished me what information he had available, and assured me that he did not believe that the cylinder recordings made of nitrate cellulose were of anywhere near the problem of similarly composed motion picture film. Leah Burt said that did not have any documentation of such fires, but Leah did not continue. Nitrate cellulose, by the way, once it carries enough oxygen in its makeup that once it begins burning, you cannot smother it. It will burn literally underwater. I've seen demonstrations of it. I didn't believe it, but I've seen it done.